The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, as promised, we talked about looking at Keynes again, even though it's an ugly picture. We have a guest today, Hunter Lewis.
Kevin, I think the importance is this. We see experiments over and over and over again with bailouts, both here in the U.S. and in Europe and around the world, and they're predicated on the same things, basically Keynesian economics. And we're now into the third round of bailouts for Greece. The first didn't work, the second didn't work, the third, well, of course, it will work. At least that's the belief. And we do the same thing over and over again, believing not that the method was wrong, but that we were only wrong by degrees. We should have done more of the same. We didn't do enough of it. We didn't spend enough. Billions weren't enough. We needed hundreds of billions. Hundreds of billions weren't enough. We need trillions. Trillions weren't enough. And this is the same kind of insanity that led to the Heversteinian nightmare, if you will.
Back in the early 1920s.
Exactly. Dr. Rudolf Heverstein, he was a very smart man, a national icon in Germany, and he had the full support of the academics of the day, saying, if things are getting more expensive, just print more money, and that way it'll be more affordable. And everyone loved the idea. No one questioned some basic assumptions. I think that's what I love about now turning back and saying, let's pause, let's think about this. We need to reassess the way we view economics. And again, this is a dismal science. Nobody particularly likes economics. But listen, your life is being predetermined for you by economic, fiscal, monetary policies, not only here in the United States, but around the world, where there's really collaboration and everyone's agreeing that we should do the same thing. This is the definition of insanity, Kevin, where you do something, it doesn't work, and yet you do it again and again and again. I'm going to explore that a little bit with Hunter Lewis today.
Well, and David, it defies common sense. And that's the thing that Keynes was known for, was defying common sense. You know, last night I was grilling steaks on the grill, and we were talking to my son. He doesn't live here. He's up in college in Boulder. And he said, who do you interview tomorrow? And we said, well, I said, Hunter Lewis. He wrote the book Where Keynes Went Wrong. And then I started to say, okay, and here's what Keynes believed. And he cut me off. And he goes, Dad, I know what Keynes believed. Spend more.
Well, and it's interesting. I think it's becoming more common knowledge that the guy was a bit of a quack. And he agreed with Sylvia Gesell's idea that you print money with an expiration date on it. In other words, you don't save it. If you own it, you need to get out there and get it moving.
Penalized for savings,
basically. He loved progressive taxation, where you take more from the wealthy and redistribute it to those who have to or will spend every bit of it, rather than save and invest. He loved the idea of setting interest rates at zero and keeping them there permanently.
How in the world would anybody retire? I don't understand. If you set interest rates at zero, what's your CD going to do for you?
It's the issue of price controls, central planning, government monopolies, the role of the state being bigger and bigger because they're better and better in his mind. And you do see shades of a worldview that puts the state in control of everything. And in fact, that was a part of Keynes's ideals, and not just in economics, but in politics. Now, if you go back to Plato's Republic, you find that Plato really fancied the philosopher king as the person who should be making all the decisions. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't trust the hoi polloi, the average voter. Well, you just, what do they really know? And really, things should be centralized around one person. Ironically, you find this figure, the philosopher king, being at the center of the universe. Keynes was no different. He created a structure of thought which propelled him to the very top. Basically, it should be central planning, and I'm your consigliere. I am your advisor. I am the philosopher king from behind the scenes who is dictating not only political issues, but also economic as well.
Well, and David, with that in mind, I mean, when we've taken economics classes in the past, we've got these ISLM curves, we've got a lot of different equations. It becomes so amazingly complicated when in reality, really all that's being taught is you need to make sure that you don't spend more than you make, and, you know, you spend productively what you spend. I would just say, when you had us read this book a couple of years ago, Where Keynes Went Wrong, as an office, and then we discussed it as an office, which is what we commonly do, it was a way of condensing voluminous material on Keynes, which, you know, I wouldn't encourage anybody to just go sit down and read all of Keynes's material. Not only does it not make sense, but it's unnecessarily complicated so that the person actually is intended not to understand what he's saying. But this book, Where Keynes Went Wrong, is a great summary of Keynes and why it doesn't make sense, and then what does make sense, wouldn't you say?
I would. And, Kevin, I think this is one of the things that gets to the heart of it for me, and I think for our listeners, too. The fact that Keynes did not take a look ahead. He was not concerned about the future. He did not care about future generations. It was not in his equation at all. Everything was about the present moment. And that's reflected in his own life. It's reflected in his personal decisions. It's reflected in his orientation to an economics which is driven by success today, irrespective of what happens tomorrow.
Like the Cavaliers, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die.
Well, and he justified it by saying, in the end, we're all dead.
Right.
So by putting that finality out there, he concentrated on the here and now, so much so, Kevin, that he betrayed future generations. And I think that's what we have to be cognizant of as thinkers, as actors in the marketplace today. We cannot afford to betray future generations, as our current body politic has done and will continue to do, to the degree that it continues to hold Keynesian ideas in its stock of beliefs.
And this is why Hunter Lewis is joining us today.
Joining us again today is Hunter Lewis, and the discussion is Keynes, his book, Where Keynes Went Wrong. As I've gone through the book yet again, this is a book that we've read in the office nearly 2 years ago, benefited from immensely. It is on the shelves of every person in the office, and we had some in-depth discussions, not only about what Keynes said, but just how confusing at times it can be and almost incoherent, except the man was truly brilliant. And that was how he got away with saying what he did. No one really wanted to challenge him. And so what Hunter Lewis has done in his book, Where Keynes Went Wrong, is just parse out some of the things said and what has been misconstrued, what has been put into place as policy and assumed to be good economic theory. So couldn't recommend the book more highly. You can either get it in hardback or paperback, and Where Keynes Went Wrong and Why World Governments Keep Creating Inflation, Bubbles, and Busts. Thank you for joining us, Hunter.
It's a pleasure.
In some respects, Keynesian economic theories were simply a justification for his own personal choices and ethical leanings, really as a rejection of 19th century social conventions or values, what was conventional morality at the time, including things like thrift, savings, and maybe even an orientation to the future. The 19th century certainly had that, predicated on traditional family structures and, again, savings for future investment. He really had a focus on the here and now, maximizing present, whether it was present pleasure or present economic stimulus. Maybe you can look at where we're at today. You know, we had this conversation to some degree 2 years ago. Has anything changed in the last 2 years in terms of the government pursuing more or less a Keynesian solution to the current economic malaise?
Not only our government hasn't changed, but every government in the world is continuing to follow the same Keynesian policies. And of course, they haven't worked. They aren't working. But we just keep doing more of the same.
You know, we find ourselves looking at that classic phrase, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. And in this case, you know, that simple shot of sugar helps the system feel better, although it doesn't necessarily bring health. And the criticism of Keynes, this is sort of a self-reflective criticism by practicing Keynesian economists, seems to be 2008 rolled around, and we gave it a spoonful. Now we found that we needed a cupful. Now we need a wheelbarrow full. Now we need a dump truck full. The only criticism seems to be we didn't do enough, and there doesn't seem to be a preceding criticism of, does this actually work? Maybe you can comment on that.
First of all, you know, back in 2009, when we were coming out of the crash, the first interview I had about the book with the BBC, they said, are you proposing to take the patient off life support? And I said, you know, that's the wrong way to look at it. It's not life support. It's just more alcohol for the alcoholic, or it's more heroin for the drug addict. And then, of course, you need more and more of that to keep an addict from being in withdrawal. But it doesn't help the problem. It just makes it worse. That's essentially what's been going on. And moreover, the most interesting thing to me is that as time has passed and as these solutions have not solved anything, but in fact have made it worse, none of the Keynesian economists who were propounding must have more stimulus are providing any justification for it on a theoretical basis or an evidence basis. They just take it for granted. I mean, every article you'll read, there was a recent one by Robert Shiller in which he said, it's undeniable that we need more stimulus now. And he doesn't explain why it's undeniable. Because the truth is, there's no logic and there's no evidence behind it.
Well, one of the things you point out in your book, Hunter, is that that actually was the force of argument that Keynes used himself. It was stated so emphatically that there really wasn't evidence that was provided, and he got away with it. In his general theory, it's not as if he built a case. He just stated emphatically, thus so, and everyone went along with it. That's been, I think, one of the particularly insightful things about your book is that really it's just a statement. There's nothing there that supports it. Maybe we can look at some of the things that, you know, again, you and I would share in common a criticism of, but maybe the listener doesn't know just what it is that gets under my skin, and I think perhaps yours as well. Ideas of, you know, the rate of interest set by the market. We're used to that. We look at the bond market as market practitioners and see that people judge credit risk, people judge ability to pay, people judge all of these things and give you basically a market grade. How do you fare in the pecking order? A junk bond may be 10-12%, and someone who's considered to be a good credit risk is maybe 2-4%. So there is that grading in the marketplace. As far as Keynes was concerned, the rate of interest, if it is set by the market, was always too high, with the ultimate target being zero. Why would Keynes target a zero interest rate policy, which frankly sounds very familiar today, why would he target that as a perpetual ideal?
This goes absolutely to the heart of what's wrong today. We have a market system which is based on prices and profits, and yet the government keeps interfering with the price system, and it's the price system that tells everybody in the market what they need to do. So they're really shutting off the flow of information that's essential to prosperity. That when you have high unemployment, that tells you that there's something wrong with the price system, that there are prices that are not in the right relationship to each other, and yet the government keeps messing up the biggest and most important prices of all, one of which is interest rates. The system really can't function if the information that the market is providing in the form of interest rate is not available. And, of course, it makes no sense at all, as Keynes said, to keep driving interest rates down to zero and hold them there. That's essentially giving away money. And, of course, we are giving away money right today. The Federal Reserve provides newly printed money to Wall Street, to firms like Goldman Sachs. They're getting virtually free money, and of course they make a lot of money with that money themselves. So then we have this problem of crony capitalism that goes along with it. All these people who are getting rich off these government policies which are not helping the economy as a whole.
So you raise an interesting point. The market system is dependent on an information feed, and prices tell you what is happening, whether it's healthy or unhealthy. And for governments to step in and play with the price system via interest rates, you're distorting the information feed, and it confuses investors. Well, it also, in a zero interest rate policy, with a zero interest rate policy, disincentivizes savers. That's also at the heart of Keynes, is it not? That you really don't want there to be a saving, or using the 19th century language, a rentier class.
That's right. He basically suggested the government could print new money, that money would flow into the economy in the form of debt, and that would take the place of saving. Of course, there's no evidence for that at all. There's no logic behind that. In fact, if you want a good economy, what you need is saving, and you need then to invest those savings, and you need to invest those savings in a wise way. And of course, Keynes, you know, he completely ignores the issue of how you're investing. For him, not only is any investment equivalent to any other investment, but spending is equivalent to investment. This just doesn't make any sense at all. If you want to restore the economy, you've got to save, you've got to invest, and above all, you have to invest wisely.
Well, and he went even further to say whatever means necessary to use up those savings. He argued, and you bring this out in your book, he argued that natural disasters, earthquakes, even wars, were a way to increase wealth by using up savings. Now, I got to kind of scratch my head on that one, but the more you use up savings, even if it's, you know, for something like what just happened in Japan, that's productive. That's a move towards an increase of wealth for the Japanese. Help me understand that.
Well, it's a complete logical fallacy, because the idea is that after the disaster, the Japanese have to spend a lot of money, and that will help the economy. But what that ignores is that they then can't spend the same money on something else, which would have been more more productive. Obviously, just restoring what they had before is not the best investment they can make. The best investment they can make would be something new and productive. So it's just illogical. It's just a logical mistake on Keynes' part, and he had lots of logical mistakes.
It sounds awfully like the broken window fallacy.
Yeah, it is the broken window fallacy, which Henry Hazlitt wrote about a long time ago, back in the 1950s. So here we have the world's governments basing their policies on Keynesian economic theory that just makes no sense.
We oftentimes discuss here in the office Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and the idea that there is no real evolution, but there is revolution within a theory of ideas, a theoretical framework, whether we're talking about a scientific framework or an economic framework or even something relating to literary theory or philosophy. There tends to be a textbook community, a group of people who have agreed what is acceptable and true knowledge. And the educational system then perpetuates what is quote-unquote real or quote-unquote true or quote-unquote reliable information. And, you know, up until the point where you have problems that cannot be solved by the prevailing paradigm, people just accept it as common knowledge. It seems we've done that with Keynesianism. Keynesianism is economics. Largely, and as you said earlier, it's not just the U.S. government, it's not just the Fed and Treasury, but if you go to any central bank or monetary authority around the world, fiscal or monetary authority around the world, they have the same bias because, well, largely they've studied at similar universities and share that same textbook knowledge. The point with Kuhn was really, you get to the point where there's too many problems that can't be solved by the existing paradigm, and then something replaces it. Do you see that as a possibility? And is the replacement a better one or a worse one, given what we have in sort of the social milieu today?
Yes, there are, in effect, intellectual bubbles, just as there are economic bubbles. And Keynesianism is an economic, is an intellectual bubble, which is underlying the economic bubbles that we've had and have got us into trouble. These things are very hard to change, but they do change. And an idea gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but eventually it does explode. The change comes very rapidly, and then it's all put behind. Some people have observed that there's a process in which these ideas change. That, first of all, an idea is ridiculed. So anti-Keynesianism in recent decades has been ridiculed. Then it's ignored because you don't want to give it, it's getting around. You don't want to give it any publicity, so the major media today, in general, tries to ignore anti-Keynesian ideas. Then it's fought ferociously, and then at the end of the process, everybody who fought it says, oh, I knew that all along. So that's the typical way that these ideas change, but eventually they do change, and they change dramatically. I have no doubt that Keynesianism is on its last legs, but in the meantime, billions of people are suffering as a result.
And again, there's real human suffering, which is far more important than something that is perhaps catastrophic to one's portfolio. But tying in something that you mentioned in your book, negative real rates, this is a chief consideration for everyone and a consequence of that manipulation of interest rates, keeping them too low too long. Negative real rates, you know, there's some practical considerations. You quote Peter Fisher, former Undersecretary of the U.S. Treasury and New York Federal Reserve Bank. It's not as if officials at the U.S. Treasury or Fed are unaware of these issues, but he says capitalism is premised on the idea that capital is a scarce commodity and we're going to ration it with a price mechanism. When you make short-term funds available essentially free with negative real rates, and you say rates lower than inflation has happened, for example, between 2001 and 2004, crazy things start to happen. That's the end of the quote. And this is where we're at today. We have negative real rates of return. There's different ways of constructing the inflation number. The models in the 80s, the models in the 90s, the way we count it today, today it's less than 3%. If it was counted by the old model in 1990, we'd be over 6. If it was counted by the Volcker view of inflation, we'd be double digit today. So we have deeply negative rates, and it forces major misallocation of capital. Maybe you can talk about the consequences of being in a negative real rate environment and the bubbles that are perpetuated. You know, really, what was set forth in 2008 is the seed of a future problem. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. But first, I want to just stress the point you way we did in the 30s, we would have depression levels showing right now a lot more than what they're saying. And we'd certainly have more inflation showing as well. We do have an environment of both inflation and unemployment. And that's, again, just the result of these bubbles that have been blown up since the mid-90s, and they've been blown up, just as you said, by holding interest rates too low, printing way too much money in an effort to keep interest rates down. A combination of too much money and too low interest rates just creates bubbles. Meanwhile, again, the Keynesian economists, and that means most economists, say, oh, bubbles are just natural. Bubbles are just part of the market system. If that's true, why is it we've had nothing but bubbles since the mid-90s, and we didn't have bubbles before that for decades? Again, it's nonsensical to say that these kind of bubbles are normal when they're so evidently abnormal, and they are the source of our problem.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
The business cycle is something that Keynes was not particularly fond of. You abolish slumps and instead seek to maintain a perpetual quasi-boom, to paraphrase him. There was, in the 19th century, you know, a period, let's say between 5 and 10 years, where it was more or less two steps forward, one step back, and a regular, if you want to call it, mini boom and mini bust cycle. Nothing deeply catastrophic, but surely painful to those who were on the wrong side of an investment. And those messes got cleaned up pretty quickly. Again, it's sort of a two steps forward, one step back process. Keynes's response was, no. Perpetual bliss, and wasn't his view really that of a utopian?
Absolutely. Again, as in any other utopian thinking, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't recognize reality. The truth is that a mild recession are the price you pay for avoiding deep recession. When you try to eliminate mild recessions, as Alan Greenspan did, Bernanke did, all you do is create the kind of problems we have today. But even in the past, when you had deep recessions or even depressions, they didn't last long. The market cured them in fairly short order. The early 1920s depression is a good example of that. The government did nothing, and it was over in about 14 months. And contrast that to the Great Depression or the kind of problems we've had since, where it just goes on and on and on, because the medicine the government applies actually just makes the patient worse. Provides temporary relief, but then doesn't solve the problem and makes it worse in the long run or even in the short run.
So you're talking about Harding and his response essentially to Herbert Hoover. Hoover suggested they pump tons of money into the system in a very Keynesian fashion. Harding said, go fly a kite or something else, and he cut the budget significantly. If I recall, he cut spending almost in half, and you know, you went from a 12% rate of unemployment to 2% by 1923, 2% and change. A very different response, and it was, as you mentioned, a deep recession. It just didn't last that long because a different solution was offered by the Harding administration.
And there's more recent evidence of that sort. When the East Asian economies got in trouble in the late 90s, they didn't have the resources to apply Keynesian policies. They acted more like Harding, and they got over it very quickly. Had a very strong rebound in no time at all. And that's in contrast to the countries that have practiced Keynesian responses, where they don't get a rebound. They don't fix the problem. They just make it worse.
Is it going to be a surprise to the average man in the street or woman in the street who comes to terms with this bankrupt ideology? Will it come as a surprise to them just how nonsensical it was to believe in it and how PhDs, very, very bright men, have held to this views, which are utterly nonsensical and very against common sense? I go back to the Red Book article that was from 1934. John Maynard Keynes wrote in answer to the question, can America spend its way into recovery? And he answered, why, obviously. The very behavior that would make a man poor could make a nation wealthy. Is it going to pass muster with the voting public that politicians of both stripes, that, you know, academics, that Wall Street geniuses, to some degree, rely on Keynes as an intellectual pillar?
Well, yeah, Keynes was always the smartest kid in the class. He always had his hand up, and he was always telling the teacher, no, everything you're saying is wrong. And so he loved to provide what seemed to be paradox. You know, too much debt causes a crash, load on more debt. It's okay to grow debt faster than income indefinitely, and so on. If debt becomes too burdensome. in itself is wrong. Real economics, which is completely violated by Keynesianism, does reflect common sense. That's what you need. You need common sense. You cannot violate common sense and expect to do anything for the poverty in the world or to help the middle class. You've got to have common sense policy. And it's just incredible that such brilliant people like Robert Shiller, whom I mentioned already, a Yale professor and greatly respected, you know, just keep clinging to these views, even though there's no logic and no evidence offered to support them. They're just completely assumed.
In recent weeks, we've talked about the Fed getting very aggressive in providing liquidity to Europe, and it's just here within recent days that they've done that, that they're providing ample liquidity through currency swaps and short-term lending via the ECB in a coordinated effort with the ECB, the Swiss National Bank, the Japanese, and we're reliquifying the system yet again. And the amazing thing is that the markets love it. The markets absolutely love it. Are the markets really that bright that they should be saying, hey, this is fantastic? I mean, it's almost, to me, it looks like the smile on the face of the dope addict who just took another hit, and boy, isn't this grand. Am I seeing this accurately?
Well, when we talk about market, in this case, we're really talking about Wall Street and Citi and people like that. And as I alluded to earlier, I mean, Wall Street has gotten rich of all these bubbles. Wall Street gets rich off the printing of the money and keeping the interest rates low. So they love this kind of thing. And they're only concerned with how much money they make in the next quarter or the next year. Now, they're certainly not concerned with the long term. So it's not surprising that the stock market goes up when these fallacious policies are pursued even more intensely. In terms of Europe, one of the big factors is that the European Central Bank operates under rules in which, if there is any default of the bonds that they hold, they have to sell them immediately or not count them as capital. So the European Central Bank is faced with technical bankruptcy unless it's completely refinanced if Greece defaults. So that, you know, just for that reason alone, they're doing everything possible to avoid a default. What a default actually is just a recognition that there's way too much debt, it can't be repaid. That's called reality. That's called common sense. And throwing more money and more money and more money after bad is not common sense.
I did a radio interview here in the last day, and the gentleman in Houston, you know, said in a somewhat unrefined manner, I look at gold as my stupid politician insurance. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I might have said it differently, but you're really talking about insurance against Keynesian economic policies when you look at a money substitute like gold. Combine negative real rates of return, combine poor policy and the fact that this is really ideologically driven, and there really is a commitment to the ideal. Someone wrote a thesis, they've staked their professional career and reputation on it, there's ego involved, and no one's going to recommend a different course until we've actually gone off the cliff. Is there a reason to assume a different investment thesis at this point, that really insurance is unnecessary, or should we still prioritize insurance in the equation? Again, perhaps not against stupid politicians, but ideas that are bankrupt themselves.
No, I think insurance is even more important. Every day that passes, it just gets more important. There are different scenarios where we go from here. We could head into a major depression or deflation, or we could into a major consumer price inflation or a combination of the two, but protecting yourself against both is extremely important. In the old days, you could protect yourself against depression by owning bonds, and the longer the bonds, the higher quality, the better. But that doesn't work right now because the chances of inflation are so great that could destroy the value of bonds. So the only things you can really rely on now are cash as a deflation hedge, gold as somewhat of a deflation hedge, and gold is also a great inflation hedge. So gold is really the prime asset. And the irony about gold is that the trouble holding gold is that you don't earn any income on it. That would normally make it seem disadvantageous to do so, but because the politicians are holding interest rates so low and refusing any kind of return to savers, it makes the no income return on gold seem not so bad.
That's that issue of negative real rates, and going back to Gibson's paradox in the Summers-Barsky thesis, low to negative rates drive investor interest into something that represents almost a sideline position. If there's too much risk and no reward, then just count me out until I can look at productive assets with a keener eye to benefit. And again, we go back to our original point. This is a market system based on prices and profits. And if profits are taken out of the equation, then people look to opt out. So to some degree, gold is an opt out.
Just want to add that the Keynesians, of course, say that if you buy gold, you're hoarding. If you just keep a savings account, you're hoarding. You're not investing, you're hurting the economy. But actually, you're helping the economy because you're keeping capital available for future investment when the opportunity finally arises to make a good, sound investment.
It seems, though, if people look at the price of the insurance, you know, you have credit default swaps, for instance, an insurance against default against a particular underlying asset. Let's take Greek paper as an example. It's trading at records of $3 million for every $10 million of underlying paper, or over 3,000 basis points. And that's even with the new ECB and U.S. interventions. That insurance seems expensive, and yet it also seemed expensive at 2,000 basis points. It seemed expensive at 1,000 basis points. It seemed expensive relative to other types of insurance at 500 basis points. The arguments being laid similarly against gold, it was expensive at 900. It was expensive at 1,200. It was expensive at 1,500. This insurance continues to get more expensive. At what point does it just, it doesn't make sense to buy the insurance because it's just flat too expensive?
Again, the Keynesian argument would be that gold is in a bubble, that it's going to burst, and every time gold retreats a bit, you read how the gold bubble is bursting. But I don't think it's a bubble at all. I think it's still just insurance, and it's still sensible insurance at this price, and it has potential to go up a lot more because, unfortunately, politicians are not going to change what they're doing anytime soon.
With the existing stock of thinkers, we probably won't see remonetization of gold. But with a different stock of thinkers and policymakers, do you see the potential for a partial remonetization?
Yes, I think that there's a great potential. In fact, I'm sure that's what will happen eventually, and it might come sooner than people think, because if the monetary system breaks down, they're going to have to find a new monetary system, you know, on short notice. Monetary systems do tend to break down every 40, 50, 60 years, and when they do, they're doubtless going to bring gold back. The danger is that they'll bring gold back in an inadequate way. You know, people talk about the gold standard being a problem in the Depression, where we didn't really have a gold standard then. We had kind of a phony gold standard, as we did after World War II. But what you really need is a true gold standard, the sort that existed before World War I, before the Federal Reserve was created. But it's less likely that they'll do that.
It seems that it's less likely because it limits government spending. And certainly the gold exchange standard as a quasi-gold standard that you just mentioned allowed for greater flexibility, so to say, in sort of freed politicians to spend wantonly. You're suggesting bringing it back in part might not be enough. Going back to the old gold standard, circa 1860 to 1914, or what the Brits had from 1717 forward, with the exception of wars here and there, what's the political context that would legitimize a full return to the gold standard?
I think the present monetary system will collapse, and when it does, they'll bring back a so-called gold standard, but it'll be something more like Bretton Woods, what we had after World War II. They certainly won't bring back a full gold standard. They could possibly avoid it. So I don't expect that to happen, but that's what's needed, because that's the only way to really control government, as you said, and prevent, you know, more and more of the same Keynesian policies of, you know, print money, spend money, borrow, spend, and bailout. All of that would not be possible under a true gold standard.
We had an interesting conversation with Giulio Garrotti, and his comment was that under a system of universal suffrage, it's very difficult to maintain those disciplines. Politicians are inclined to spend more on their constituency groups than under a gold standard, or what a gold standard would allow for. So perhaps a return to disciplines reflective of the gold standard, but certainly not a return to the full gold standard. And he said that just the era post-World War II was different. We've moved towards universal suffrage, and politicians won't allow for it. And frankly, neither would constituency groups, because it would mean less money from the government trough. Would you feel like that's an accurate assessment?
No, because the problem is not the universal suffrage. The problem
Yeah.
The special interest groups, the big businesses, the unions, the trial lawyers, and so on. They're the people who are active in Washington, Wall Street, you know, who are active in Washington, who are actually deriving benefits from all these Keynesian policies. And the country as a whole is not. The average voter is not. So if the average voter really understood what was going on, they certainly wouldn't support this kind of thing.
That's a very good distinction.
There's nothing about democracy that I think that leads us to this problem. In fact, we need more participation from the average voter and the average person, not less.
You see the present monetary system unwinding. Any thoughts on the euro? Any thoughts on, you know, a basket of currencies? Certainly, Keynes was fond of the Bancor idea. The IMF and the SDR structure is certainly being bandied about a bit. What do you see as the world's money system 3-4 years out? What would you speculate would be our reality?
Well, the most likely outcome would be to try to go back to the system that Nixon destroyed, the post-World War II system. But certainly, you know, we don't need Keynes Bancor. We don't need the SDRs. And so, I mean, that's just an international organization printing money in addition to individual governments printing money. So that just magnifies the problem and makes it even worse. What we need to stop is all the money printing. So that certainly does take us where we need to go.
So something very similar to Bretton Woods, where currencies relate to a particular sound or more sound currency. That was the dollar. Do you think that's the dollar still? Barry Eichengreen would argue that probably not. It'll have to be a duopoly, certainly not a dollar monopoly any longer.
Yes, it's quite hard to imagine that the dollar would remain the sole reserve currency under a new system. That's certainly not very likely. In terms of the euro, I was just hearing on the radio yesterday, you know, a distinguished commentator saying, well, you know, we have a choice here. Either the European governments will intervene and rescue the euro and save the day by basically bailing out Greece and other countries, or they'll let the euro collapse and that'll be a disaster and that will cost the European governments much more money in the long run, 6 times as much money. But that's just all fallacious, because bailing out Greece or bailing out Portugal doesn't solve anything. Again, you have to accept reality that their debts simply cannot be repaid. You have to accept default, and then you have to rebuild from there. The idea that those are the only two choices is essentially just basically ridiculous. And we also have to keep in mind that actually, if they kicked Greece out of the euro could appreciate considerably, so that there actually is the possibility that if the Germans don't buckle under and they kick bad performers out, they could actually make the euro a very attractive currency again, more attractive than the dollar. No one's talking about that possibility.
That's been our position, that if you take the barnacles off the underside of the boat, you've got much smoother sailing.
Right.
What you said about the distinguished commentator from Europe giving those two alternatives, I just want to come back to your book, because this is one of the gifts that you have, Hunter, in pointing out just the logical inconsistencies. And here's one example of the fallacy of false alternative. But you look at Keynes and you say, oh, come on, he's misusing technical language. He shifts definitions. He misuses even common terms. He confuses cause and effect. He creates things that are, you know, representative of false determinism. You go through and you, I think it's a very fair portrayal. You let him speak. And then you add some comment to it and say, guys, come on, wait a minute. Does this make sense to you? And again, kind of coming back to not just common sense, but also a keen criticality, a real insightful, logical appraisal of where Keynes went wrong. And just, again, want to encourage listeners, if you don't feel like you know what is being done to you, not necessarily for you, but to you under the current administration, the past administrations, and as we've pointed out in this conversation, not just here in the United States, but globally, by the fiscal and monetary authorities, you should know Keynes. You should know him on a first-name basis. You need to get to know him. Make your introduction to him. Get a copy of Hunter's book. If you have interest beyond that, then certainly order an original copy of Keynes' writing and dig into the primary text as well. But this is a great introduction. Hunter, I want to thank you for opening up the conversation and getting people thinking. We don't know in the future what will have turned the tide. but you've offered an opportunity. You've set something out there that I think critical thinkers, people who care about our country and the direction it goes, and frankly the world, can look at and say, wow, I didn't think about that. I need to reappraise. I need to check my assumptions. As logical as my macroeconomics class in college seemed, it appears that the professor and myself, we didn't reassess our assumptions, and that needs to be done. So thank you for sort of raising the questions and presenting that for the average American to take a look at and say, we need a different set of ideas. Let's see if we can get that done.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Look forward to our future conversations. And again, you can find Where Keynes Went Wrong at Amazon.com or at any of your media outlets, and either the hardback or the paperback. We ordered it by the case and hope you will too.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Hunter Lewis, author of Where Keynes Went Wrong. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.